Scott Williams is the Senior Vice President of the Men's Health Network in Washington, D.C., which is a not-for-profit advocacy organization that's been in existence in 1992 that advocates for the education and policy to help increase the health of boys and men in America, as well as look to the health of families in America. One of the missions of the Men's Health Network is to bring health care programs and education to where men live, work, play, and pray, and bring preventive messages and tools to help public health officials and practitioners provide health services for men. Mr. Williams is a contributing author to the American Journal of Men's Health. He is a frequent speaker and lecturer about health policy as it relates to men and families. He's also serves as a membership chair for the American Public Health Association's Community Health Planning and Policy Development Section. He's representative to the Partnership to Fight Chronic Diseases, Medicare Rx Education Network, and currently holds positions within the One Voice Against Cancer Budget and Communications Work Groups. He is president of the Maryland's Men's Health Network Board of Directors, and Scott also serves on the Retire Safe Board of Directors program. Prior to joining the Men's Health Network, Scott was a senior analyst of strategic services at Farmstrat, which is, he has wonderful credentials in market research. And he also worked in public relations manager at Sanofi Pasteur for a brief time. Scott received his BA in political science and honors, and he recently completed his MPH program from American University. Okay, very apropos. Mr. Williams, go ahead.
Thanks. Man, really sorry about that bio. That was pretty ridiculous. So, sorry, Dr. George. I'm sorry to all of you that ate up time here this morning. So, how's everybody doing today? Good? All right. So as you guys look at men's health, how many of you are practitioners in the field running programs or outreach to men or boys currently? Great. Wonderful. So about a quarter of the room here is in one way or another engaged in men's health education, outreach, awareness, and advocacy efforts, which is absolutely great because we'll be talking a little bit about that today and some of the implications of the Affordable Care Act in that space. So I have no financial disclosures to report, and I just wanted to build off of what Sal was mentioning here and give you guys a little bit of context for our organization and to talk a little bit about why we care about this issue and how we've gone about trying to address it and working together with public health professionals and practitioners just like yourselves. So our mission, as Sal mentioned, is to reach out to men and their families as they live, work, play, and pray, recognizing, as Sal mentioned, that we have a huge both area of opportunity but also need in terms of reaching out to men in environments that they trust and that they're comfortable. So to that end, we go out to large corporate employers like Harley-Davidson, John Deere, Anheuser-Busch, UPS, NASA, and others, and really reach men at work, recognizing it's a great way to do it. Also, faith-based communities are absolutely critical, as well as community health centers, as well as our work within a lot of sports and entertainment franchises. I don't know if you guys have caught on with some of our work with the NFL here recently, but we've hosted essentially family health education, screening, and wellness events in players' locker rooms of a variety of these NFL teams, and it's been a great way to get both men and women in the community out to take advantage of preventive health screenings, but also learn a little bit more about their family's health, as well as preventative health checkups that they may need as well. So I wanted to set the stage a little bit, and Dr. Giorgiani actually had done this a little bit for me already this morning, but what are some of the key issues, and why are we facing some of the challenges that we are? And I believe, I don't know how many of you attended Dr. Jean Bonhomme's presentation yesterday afternoon in the masculinity panel, but he kind of sets the stage as this men's health problem starts early on. It really starts with the socialization of boys and young men. And he really tells it best that, you know, when a boy falls down and skins his knee at 5 years old, his mom or dad says, you know, suck it up, big boys don't cry. And then when that boy essentially grows up to become a man, essentially when you hit the age of 50 and maybe this man is experiencing chest pain, you know, it's no problem, it's just indigestion, but it really may be the first sign of a heart attack or a cardiac event. So again, what does that socialization and that discussion around health early on lead to men as they age and continue down the continuum of life and care. We've also seen some of the unique challenges in this space too, resulting around if you have 16 to maybe 18-year-old boys that are receiving screenings or checkups or annual visits and physicals, maybe it's sports-related, maybe it's school-related, what happens to these boys as they exit the school system? And essentially in that age range of 18 to 50, there's almost this cliff, if you will. I know many of our policymakers right now are talking about a fiscal cliff, but I guess what I'm talking about here is a health cliff that we're experiencing with boys as they transition into manhood. What's happening and where are these guys engaging in the healthcare system after we lose them at about 18 and maybe they're not showing up again until the age of 50, maybe with some sexual health or cancer-related issues to their urologist or oncologist? And that's really the first time that we've seen them in the system in maybe 20 to 30 years. And what impact does that have on society, on payers, on the federal government, and us as institutions working to improve their health and well-being? So let's talk about some of the social determinants of health. That is my food god pyramid right there, so I guess I need to practice what I preach. But when you look at the key issues around men's health, what is the problem? The problem is that men are more likely to be uninsured. They're about half as likely to see a healthcare provider as their female counterparts. They're less likely to have a primary care provider. And then finally, they're also the victims of about 92% of the workplace accidents as well as deaths that occur in this country. So what are these issues? What are the social determinants affecting health? Also, there's education-related issues. Currently, if you look at boys and men, boys and young men and men in general are receiving about 25% fewer college degrees than their female counterparts. And as we know as public health practitioners, that has an impact because better education equals better jobs, better income, better health and well-being over the course of their lifespan. Also, as I like to call it, the man session that we just went through in the recession, what are those key issues around job loss, around stress, anxiety, burden on families, burden on both women and men in terms of losing jobs and the impact on health? And then finally, the really unique challenges we have around mental health with men, around depression and suicide, and those extremely high recurring rates of issues there that we're facing all across the nation. So I kind of painted a bleak picture, but I want to transition over to the positive picture. And I think this is a story that hasn't been told a lot as we've talked about the Affordable Care Act and what is going on around male health. There's so many activities going on across the federal government right now in male health that really aren't getting the positive light shined on it that needs to be shined right now. And I wanted to touch on a few of these. In May of 2007, there was a movement in Congress to create a Congressional Men's Health Caucus. The current co-chairs, and I'll talk a little bit about it later, are actually two former NFL football players. So when you talk about getting these, in quotes, macho men to step up and be willing to talk about health, take ownership, be accountable, and do something to improve the health and well-being of men and boys, that is currently happening. The Affordable Care Act also had a provision creating an Office of Indian Men's Health within the Indian Health Service. Healthy People 2010, as well as Healthy People 2020, had specific verbiage and language around gender disparities to make sure that it looked at both women's health issues as well as men's health issues. There's some great efforts going on in the White House around fatherhood, similarly with faith-based initiatives in the administration as well. You look at minority health initiatives and the new offices of minority health that were created at CMS and other federal agencies that are also engaging in men's health activity. We recently partnered with the NIH Office of Research on Women's Health on that campaign, specifically mentioned women being the key or the portal to men's health and family health. The great work that we've been able to do with David and Lee and Stacy here around the Male Reproductive Health Alliance. It's been a collaborative partnership around nonprofit institutions, federal agencies, as well as other related groups working collaboratively together to address male reproductive health issues. Dave is going to talk about the work around male family planning and Title X. And then recently here, too, the National Institute of Mental Health had initiated a Real Men, Real Depression campaign. So before we kind of really dive in on what the Affordable Care Act is doing around male health, I really wanted to point out the successes and a lot of this great activity on the federal level that's currently happening around male health, because I think this paints a positive picture and also a picture that all of us, I think, can rally around to talk about what more needs to happen, but also the great work that is happening currently. So again, I talked about the Congressional Men's Health Caucus. This is a key body and something that I think all of us that are involved and interested in this field can really leverage. When this group was first created, we had Representative Tim Murphy, who is a child psychologist and a Republican from Pennsylvania, who joined with his Democratic colleague, Representative Barron Hill from Indiana, who is essentially a fitness freak and a fitness nut, but is very passionate about men's health issues. So a bipartisan effort came together on Capitol Hill to address these men's health issues. Unfortunately, Representative Hill is no longer in Congress, and Representative Murphy is the chair of the Mental Health Caucus within Congress. So we identified two other champions. And as I mentioned, the two former NFL football players, we have Congressman Runyon, the Republican from New Jersey, and Congressman Shuler, the Democrat from North Carolina. Both these individuals have had serious men's health issues impacting their family. For them, it's extremely personal. The caucus serves a very important role. It can host and facilitate congressional briefings on male health issues. The most recent briefing that we had had was specifically around brain injury issues that impacting both the military but also athletes. It was a great discussion because it looked at the NFL. It looked and compared it with what's going on at the DOD, with also what's going on at the VA, and then also with the NFL Players Association. So it looked across the broad spectrum of the impact of TBI and brain injury essentially on our families and on folks that are participating either in the military or in athletics. I also wanted to talk about what's going on the state level. And this was a poster presentation that I'd actually presented 4 years ago here at APHA about what's going on the state level around male health. And again, where does the Affordable Care Act come into play here? So 4 years ago, when this nationwide survey was conducted, here I wanted to share this data because when we did the secondary analysis again in 2010, not much of this data had changed, and we're almost here ready to finalize the 2012 survey and update around what's going on the state level. So let's dive into the data. When you look in 2008, we had 12 states that had established an Office of Men's Health or a coordinator for men's health in their respective area. And that compared to about 42 states and the District of Columbia that had something similar to it for women's health. 4 states that had state commissions on men's health, 33 states that had commissions on women's health, 14 states in D.C. that had a website with dedicated information around men's health, and 50 states in D.C. that had information around women's health. And what this study is really meant to do is to point out what's going on for men's health, what's going on for women's health, and what are the current resources and availability of tools in the respective areas to help improve the health and well-being of our families in this nation. And I think it tells a pretty powerful story because I think you could kind of look at it two ways. A first way is, man, you know, there actually is some good activity going on the state level around male health issues. It's not to the level that we would have hoped to address the burden and the area of need. However, we are making progress and the steps are going in the right direction. What more can we do and what will the Affordable Care Act help us do in terms of increasing these numbers on the male health side? Also, our organization has led development of what we've called State of Men's Health Reports, as well as, I don't know if many of you have seen these recent movements around report cards. I know Vanderbilt University and Tennessee in particular had published a men's health report card. We had worked with several other states to publish them, including North Carolina and others. And it's essentially a snapshot in time to be able to track using a lot of the indicators and principles within Healthy People 2020 and previously 2010, to be able to measure and track our progress in the states around what's going on around male health issues. So again, this state-by-state snapshot that I think is complemented by the federal effort around some of those activities I was mentioning a little bit earlier. So let's dive in a little bit and let's look at what's in the Affordable Care Act that is impacting male health and family health. And I have to start out by saying that we don't view men's health and women's health as a competitive thing. This is about how can men and women work together to build healthy families in this country. And I have to say, too, that we view women as a key portal, much like our campaign with the NIH Office of Research on Women's Health, as a portal to women, both women's health, men's health, as well as family health. So this is a collaborative effort, and it's not meant to pit the genders against each other. So what I'm pointing out here is that there are some amazing things in the Affordable Care Act that were done to improve women's health, and I just wanted to point those out. So the Affordable Care Act codified the Offices of Women's Health in those variety of areas that you can see above here at ARC, at CDC, FDA, HRSA. It took the step of creating a coordinating committee on women's health. It also established the National Women's Health Information Center. And then you see a variety of work down there with ORWH, NIH, as well as SAMHSA. So a lot of great activity around women's health that was codified thanks to the Affordable Care Act. Also, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we were successful in advocating for the need for an Office of Men's Health at the Indian Health Service. As many of you know, with a lot of these legislative issues, it's all in the language. This language had essentially said that the Indian Health Service may create an Office of Indian Men's Health rather than shall create an Office of Indian Men's Health, and that very small difference in the language leads us to a different place. So right now, this office has not yet formally been named. Director Rubido is certainly aware of the need to do this. Right now, there is a very high understanding of the unique challenges going on in Indian country and with Native American men, women, and families, and the need for something like this. So we're continually optimistic that this will happen. We actually had two researchers up at Indian Health Service who, when this originally passed, kind of dove into the data and into the research to better understand, do we really need something like this? Because the first reaction was, why would we need something like this? Those two researchers called us back 2 weeks after they initiated this research and said, oh my God, we had no idea that it was this bad in Indian country when it comes to men's health issues. They had said, we need this. We need to make this happen. And since that time, for a year and a half, they've been working with Director Rubido to find a way to hopefully make this happen and make it real. Also, on the women's health side, we saw Senator Mikulski step up and do something that was really important. What she did was she introduced legislation that essentially provided preventative services to women for free and at no cost. And it pointed back to the guidelines supported by HRSA to essentially say what women should get and what it should be provided for at no cost. We had some follow-up conversations with Senator Mikulski's office around could there be a similar package for men's preventive services to be covered for free and at no cost. And unfortunately at this time, it just wasn't identified as a priority with her office or the Congress. However, we're cautiously optimistic that this could be something. I'll share a little bit more data here about some other movements that have been going on. But we look at this as a model that I think we can learn from and an opportunity for us in male health to really follow what's been done around women's preventive services to have a similar preventive services package for men and boys. So let's talk a little bit more about that. So since that time and since that conversation, what's happened and what's going on next? We linked up with the Veterans Health Council and Women Against Prostate Cancer to essentially establish what this preventive services package could look like. And we focused on five key areas. Obviously, prostate cancer, given the challenges around the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, was one of those key issues that we felt was critical to have a part of this preventive services package. For those that are high-risk men, we understand that we can't have a broad-based screening program that's targeting all men around prostate cancer, but at least have something that's going after African-American men, men with a family history, as well as veterans who have been exposed to Agent Orange. Again, those men, they're at highest risk. And then we also worked with our friends and colleagues at CDC around the need for HPV access and availability for boys. And specifically, as many of you know, ACIP had approved recommendations for a routine HPV vaccination for 11 and 12-year-old boys. So this was something that we can point to, which was a success, that I think would, again, contribute to the development of a preventive services package for boys and men. And we also mentioned chlamydia and gonorrhea because that was included in the Women's Preventive Services Package. And we said, if you're going to screen women and girls for chlamydia and gonorrhea, shouldn't we also be doing that for boys and men as well, so that we're not getting in a situation where the girls are getting checked and getting taken care of, but we're not taking care of kind of the other half of the equation in many cases and the partners, and we're not screening them. And then finally, we were advocating to, many of you are probably aware of the Well Woman visit that currently exists within the federal government. We were also advocating, why couldn't we have a Well Man visit? When we talked a little bit earlier about that cliff that we're experiencing in boys when they hit age 18 and then we don't see them again until they're 50, could that Well Man preventative care annual visit be that opportunity to re-engage men in the healthcare system for that 32-year window where we're experiencing that gap? And we think that it can be, and I think that well-man visit could probably incorporate some of those four items that are above mentioned there. The Affordable Care Act, as many of you know, certainly had some great provisions around Medicaid expansion. And I'm sure that you've seen and heard probably from men in the communities in which you work that in many cases men weren't eligible for Medicaid. However, with the changes in eligibility, this is a very unique opportunity for us to get more men into the system. Out of these 16 to 17 million new entrants into the Medicaid program, we had done an analysis working with many state Medicaid directors, and it looks as though about 9 to 10 million men are going to be coming into the Medicaid system as a result of the new eligibility and the way in which this was crafted. So we're excited by that opportunity, the opportunity to get 9 to 10 million men that aren't currently insured into the Medicaid system to provide access. The unique thing for the states is that the federal government's going to be picking up the tab on the cost of Medicaid for the first 3 years. So you would think if you're a state and you have 10 million men coming into the system, you might want to get them in early and maybe take advantage of something like a Welcome to Medicaid physical that looks kind of like the Welcome to Medicare physical that exists currently and is existed for almost 20 years, so that when a man would come in, it's almost like a benchmark snapshot in time to say, here's what this man's health looked like as he's entering into the system, and trying to make prevention and early detection a priority to hopefully save the system money downstream and hopefully save the state some money as well, with the federal government picking up the tab for the first 3 years. So we kind of see Medicaid as a unique opportunity to improve male health and men's health, but we also think that this Welcome to Medicaid physical idea could maybe be a next frontier, and we could probably leverage some of the learnings from Medicare. I mentioned the task force. I guess I won't dive in a little bit more on this one too far, but did want to mention that grade D recommendation that we're currently sitting here with currently. What we have noticed up in Congress is that there was actually a reform bill that was introduced in a bipartisan fashion by Representative Blackburn and Representative Barrow. So Representative Blackburn is a congresswoman from the state of Tennessee. Representative Barrow from Georgia, who is a prostate cancer survivor, looked at this and said, we need to kind of upgrade the way the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force goes about making its recommendations. We need to have key stakeholders at the table. We need the patient voice. We need the provider voice. We need to include the external experts and make sure that they're using the best available data. If you talk to many advocates in this field, many of them will say, you know, the PLCO study, which was used as kind of the foundation and the core of what informed this recommendation, was a flawed study. Everyone knows it. So how can we make sure that we are incorporating the best practices, the key evidence, and the best research to make these recommendations? And really, with what Representative Blackburn and Barrow have done, it seems like they're starting to move in that direction to really inform the task force and help them see and follow up and do many of the things that they're currently advertising on their website. If you look at the task force website, they mention that they're doing a lot of these things. From what we've seen from Blackburn and Barrow's office, they feel like H.R. 5998 is a way to encourage them to continue to do some of those activities that would upgrade and reform the process a little bit. Also, I wanted to bring up PCORI really quick. So the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, again, was another piece of the pie here. And I bring it up because PCORI had hired recently a director of stakeholder engagement and a director of patient engagement, which I feel like is very critical for all of us in public health to know, because back on May 23rd, PCORI made its first funding announcement, and they identified several four focus areas for funding. They mentioned prevention, diagnosis, treatment, improving healthcare systems, research, and addressing disparities, all of those things which are critically important to APHA. So how can we, as a public health association and even as a men's health caucus, better interact with this group because there's funding available? And then also they have within their mission to reach out to all of us as key stakeholders to better inform research and comparative effectiveness research going on all across this country. So again, we kind of see this as a unique area of opportunity. And then also, certainly IPAB has gotten a lot of play in the media, but one of our concerns as we looked at IPAB was that there's no patient representation on the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Unfortunately, it's exempt from judicial and administrative review. So we're essentially trying to make sure if there are going to be changes or cuts that are recommended to Medicare and Medicaid systems, let's make sure we have the voices at the table from the patient community to help inform this, so that whether we're talking women's health or men's health, we're not taking steps back in terms of the progress that we've made with the Affordable Care Act and other movements to improve the health and well-being of everyone. So what's coming up in these upcoming decisions? I'll just kind of blow through this, but I'm sure many of you guys have seen this with the upcoming elections here. So everything's getting lumped into the lame duck session, right? So here's some of just the quotes from the media. Make sure to get your shopping done early because it's going to be ugly. It's lame-ageddon. The agenda sends shivers down people's spines about what we're going to have to be dealing with. So what are the big-ticket items? We've got a lot of things coming up here. We've got sequestration. We've got increasing the debt ceiling. We've got to look at Medicare doc payment, payroll tax cut, unemployment benefits, you name it, a couple things that may happen in the next week or two right before the elections, and then, you know, essentially what happens if we do nothing. You know, we're all looking at a pretty big burden, about $4 trillion come January 2013 if the can keeps getting kicked down the road. So I bring it up because I really believe that this deficit debate and this whole issue around sequestration obviously is going to have some pretty dangerous implications for healthcare policy. And my question coming out of this is that as we go through the next month and a half after the elections and as we look ahead towards January of 2013, how can we work together to make sure that the health and well-being of men, boys, their families, as well as women and girls are protected, and also making sure that we as advocates fit within a lot of these changes and a lot of these cuts are going to be happening? Because the last thing we want is to lose a lot of this progress and the great work that I mentioned earlier that's happening on the federal and the state level. So how can we make sure working together that that doesn't happen, that we're not actively taking steps back from the progress that I really believe that we've made over the past year or two? So I wanted to conclude with what we're doing about it. So our organization last Thursday actually hosted a Men's Health Brain Trust meeting. And what we did is we brought together key leaders and stakeholders from a variety of groups. We looked at the private sector, the public sector, patient groups, federal agencies, provider groups, media and PR firms, and brought together some key organizations like the Boy Scouts of America, Men's Health Magazine, veterans organizations, seniors organizations, to have a conversation amongst 50 key organizations to say, where do we go from here? How do we inform policy? How do we move the male health agenda forward? And what we found out was that we heard a couple things, and it sounded as though we might have a unique opportunity to create an interagency forum on men's health, or maybe even a coordinating committee around men's health. I mentioned all that great federal activity that was occurring. How can we have everyone talk to each other across the variety of entities, agencies, and silos of work that's going on right now that's doing some really great things to improve male health? So these were some of the key learnings and key takeaways from that Brain Trust. And then we're also looking at a white paper. This is a previous one, but coming out of the Brain Trust, we had identified kind of a Why Men's Health, Why Now white paper that I think we're going to have an opportunity to publish with a lot of the key members of the Brain Trust, really building off of the story of this American Journal of Men's Health article that was published last year that really tried to quantify what is the impact of male health on society, on payers, on the federal government. I can give you the Cliff Notes version of this. If you look at it, we're losing annually about $500 billion by ignoring the health and well-being of boys and men. So again, from an economic standpoint, and as we're trying to justify why do we need to do more, studies like this I think can be really helpful. And then also I wanted to mention a movement that we initiated with Dr. Giorgiani here as well as Dr. Porsche is to create a core curricula around male health that would be cross-cutting across public health, across nursing, across urology, primary care, social work, so that we as practitioners in this field can all be working off the same song sheet. And also we've taken a step as an organization to create a men's health certification. This certification is going to be an 8 to 12 hour live training program that for all of you that are practitioners out in the field can work hand in hand with our faculty at Men's Health Network to get you, your staff, or those in which you work, up to speed and certified to do men's health education, outreach, and awareness in a way that's going to be effective around some of these specific core curricula areas that were mentioned in the previous slide. So I wanted to conclude with this slide. How can you get involved? What work yet needs to be done? We need the voices. We need the personal stories. All of you are working with men in some way in your communities, within your families, or have loved ones that have been impacted in some way or another. Please help us by sharing those personal stories with us. We've had many public health interns join us. If you're at a school and you're interested in having folks get involved in health policy or get involved in advocating around men's health issues, please join us. You can certainly, as Sal mentioned, join the Men's Health Caucus here within the American Public Health Association. We were formed about 2 years ago, and we've nearly tripled in size since when we were founded around the time of the Denver annual meeting. So it's a growing movement here within APHA. You can also partner with us in June, which is Men's Health Month, and as many of you know, with Father's Day and Men's Health Week, it's a great time to talk about these issues in your local community. And finally, we all know about the power of social media. Check us out on Twitter, on Facebook. You can contribute to our Talking About Men's Health blog. We want to do everything we can to continue this conversation because we really believe the Affordable Care Act presents us with some great opportunities and some great steps to really improve male health. Thank you very much.
Have a few minutes for questions. Maybe we'll take two questions now for Scott, and then we'll do some questions at the end, depending on time. Any questions for Scott at this point? Yes, ma'am, in the green.
A second question. There is an area that then you sometimes get what is pre-employed.
Yes.
Latino healthcare in Los Angeles.
Good. I'd love to follow up with you on that. Yeah, thank you.
Gentlemen.
So, you know, when it comes to the Muslims, Medicaid, you know, Medicaid is not just some students have it. I cannot wait if I get Medicaid.
Right.
So is there any kind of assistance work or anything that's happening with community health centers or providers that just, you know, part of it that helps to overcome some of the reasons why women don't access care there, and help create opportunities so that we can have some.
Yeah, your point is a perfect one, because as we started talking about the Welcome Medicaid physical opportunity, we were on the phone with the Medicaid director in Massachusetts who said, obviously he'd had some key learnings there, but then he had referred us over to the Illinois Medicaid director and said, certainly the challenges and issues that you just raised are very real, and said, you know, we need to develop a strategy. We need to form some sort of body and movement and educational pieces and awareness activity to help address that, because I think your point's a good one. If we're going to have this opportunity for 10 million men to enter, how can we make sure they're actually going to take advantage of it and it's going to be viewed as a positive, right, and an opportunity for care and access. So I don't think we figured it out, but we certainly welcome the opportunity to collaborate and partner to make sure that, you know, we're doing the best that we can.
Thank you, Scott.